This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com.
Duncan, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. Your knowledge of the fields we cover always makes the dialogue just flow so beautifully. And also, there's something about the very nature of a dialogue as you do that is a kind of parallel to the whole attitude towards life and towards the cosmos that I think certainly my book is trying to support. And I think our whole kind of spiritual challenge of our civilization at this time is to move into a more dialogical mode with each other, with other cultures, between male and female, between generations, and between humanity and other forms of life and with the cosmos itself. So in a sense, I think maybe what we're doing here as a personal dialogue and that you do with so many people who visit with you is a kind of microcosm of this larger dialogical imperative, really, that calls us in our time.
Well, thank you so much, Rick. It's really a wonderful opportunity to celebrate all of us together with all of our deep listeners in an alive universe and in a cosmos full of beauty and wonder and possibility. From time immemorial, beginning with indigenous councils and ancient wisdom traditions, through the work of Western visionaries such as Plato, Galileo, and quantum physicist David Bohm, mutually participatory dialogue has been seen as the key to evolving and transforming consciousness, evoking a flow of meaning, a dia flow of logos, meaning, beyond what any one individual can bring through alone. So join us now, as together with you, the active deep listener, we evoke and engage in living dialogues. Welcome to Living Dialogues. I'm your host, Duncan Campbell, and with me for this particular dialogue, I'm truly delighted to have my friend and author, Richard Tarnas, with me for this particular program. Rick was born in 1950 in Geneva, Switzerland, of American parents, and his first book, The Passion of the Western Mind, became a bestseller and continues to be widely read in universities and seminaries throughout the world. He currently teaches on the faculty of the California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, where he is the founding director of Philosophy, Cosmology, and Consciousness Graduate Studies Program. He also teaches on the faculty of the Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara. Of his first book, The Passion of the Western Mind, Joseph Campbell said, this is, quote, the most lucid and concise presentation I have read of the grand lines of what every student should know about the history of Western thought. The writing is elegant and carries the reader with the momentum of a novel. It is really a noble performance, close quote. And I couldn't agree more, Rick, and we've been waiting actually for 30 years now for the apparent sequel to The Passion of the Western Mind, first published in 1991, now in use in over 80 or 90 universities, and it's finally arrived, the much-anticipated Cosmos and Psyche, Intimations of a New Worldview, your masterwork here, and in fact, as you reveal in the introduction and prologue to Cosmos and Psyche, this book, this new book, is actually the central contribution of your life work, and The Passion of the Western Mind, in a sense, was a great prequel, reviewing the entire history of Western thought in order to prepare the ground for a receptivity to an alive universe that speaks to us in many ways different even than the great philosophical and psychological insights that we're familiar with. And so it's perhaps best to situate you and your work, I think, at this point by going back to the work of, say, Freud and Jung and Stan Grof in the depth psychology tradition, that the great breakthrough that Freud made at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th, and then the a discovery, if you will, or the articulation of the collective unconscious, taking it beyond personal biography that occurred with Jung, and then Stan Grof's great work, where he extended both the Freudian and the Jungian analysis and created what's been known as transpersonal psychology by introducing another element which we can describe, all laying the table, if you will, for your work, Cosmos and Psyche, in which you, building on that prior tradition, reclaim the great tradition of ancient astrology and create what you and Stan have called archetypal psychology and what you call archetypal astrology. And really, this archetypal astrology is creating, as you put it, I think brilliantly, an archetypal telescope through which we can actually see and understand a wider and vaster universe. So with that situational introduction, let's just start there with maybe a little biographical note of your own, of maybe the time when you were a child, or maybe the time when you were at Esalen, where all this began, looking at the night sky as a night guard at Esalen Institute in California, because you've thanked in your introduction the great California coastline, the power and majesty of the ocean and the cliffs and the night sky and the clarity of being able to see it in that beautiful location far from the urban scene.
Well, thank you for welcoming me again to speak with you in this way, Duncan. It's a pleasure to be here. The period that you're talking about was 30 years ago. Actually, just a little more than 30 years ago, I came to Esalen Institute to study, actually, with Stanislav Grof at that point. I had studied psychology during my 4 years at Harvard, focusing on Freud and Jung at that time. And I'd
that
heard
was in the early 70s?
Yeah, 1968 to 1972 were my 4 years there. So it was that kind of period that was really at the peak of countercultural ferment in places like, you know, Cambridge and New York and New Haven and Ann Arbor and Madison and Berkeley.
Yeah, I myself Boulder was actually at Harvard Law School from 67 to 70. So
we overlapped
in that very key period,
yes,
without knowing each other. And when the Harvard strike happened,
that's right,
in two successive
years. Very dramatic
years.
Period. Yeah,
very dramatic period.
So I heard about Grof's work there, and I remember reading a statement of Abraham Maslow, who was one of the founders of transpersonal psychology with Stan Grof. And he described Grof's first book as being the most important contribution to psychology since Freud. I was quite impressed with that, particularly because I knew that Grof had worked with very powerful psychoactive substances as adjuncts to psychotherapy, such as LSD. I thought anybody who was able to work fruitfully with that kind of powerful, pharmaceutical adjunct to psychotherapy, and he had a capacity to somehow integrate both Freudian psychoanalysis with the mystical perspectives of the human psyche that came from Hinduism and Buddhism and so forth. I thought, this is somebody I'd like to study with. So I'd come to Esalen in the early to mid 1970s.
Let's just pause there to remind people that by the time you got to Esalen, LSD had been declared illegal in the United States, and so Stan Grof was no longer able to use it as he had in his native Czechoslovakia. When it was legal to use it,
he could, for those years from 67 to 73, he did have the legal right and permission to use it in that very structured way in Maryland Psychiatric Research Institute, working through the Johns Hopkins University and for the National Institute of Mental Health. But it was very limited, so he could only do, for example, three sessions per person, which is not adequate to the kind of work that, you can activate something in that time without being able to fully explore and integrate it.
And I meant really to say that by the time he got to Esalen, it was declared illegal. So
yeah,
that when you were working
it.
With him, he had already moved on to holotropic breathwork, or the beginning of his work that would lead to holotropic breathwork. Yeah, I was aware of that work in Maryland, but by the time you became affiliated with him, you were moving into other arenas to replace what LSD, in a sense, had offered.
Also, actually, when I came to Esalen, Stan got there in late 1973, and he became the scholar-in-residence for the next 15 years or so. And I came in early 1974, right about the time that Alan Watts passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And Stan, at that point, was putting all his focus on writing up and publishing the results of those, 15, 20 years of research that he'd been doing. So I was studying with him, working on my doctorate at that point. And I then had my first position at Esalen was as a night guard at, for Esalen, which is situated right on the cliffs of Big Sur on the high cliffs overlooking the Pacific, far out into the wilderness, away from the urban areas, so that the stars and planets and the moon were extremely bright and luminous. And I spent many a night from, you know, late at night, midnight, 1 o'clock, all the way into till dawn, where I was, you know, often alone and just being able to take in the majesty and the beauty, but also a kind of mystery of the night sky and the changing planetary positions and the constellations. And at that point, I didn't know any astrology and didn't really have any reason to take it seriously, but I almost feel as if some preparation, in retrospect, I feel almost as if some kind of preparation was happening to, in a sense, initiate me into a deeper grasp of that mystery. And what was the turning point was in early 1976, so we're talking exactly 30 years ago, and I think this is what you meant when you said that we've been waiting 30 years, because it was exactly 30 years ago that basically the evidence started pouring in, and the basis for Cosmos and Psyche, the book I just published, was laid. And that came as a result of learning how to calculate birth charts and then what are called transits or personal transits. That is where the planets are in the sky relative to where they were at the time of your birth. And
how did you first start this work, actually? Was it you that initiated this, or Stan, or how did this first really come about?
Well, both Stan and I had brief encounters with individuals who gave us reason to believe that there might be something intellectually valuable about astrology that we, prior to that time, simply had given no credence to it. So independently, Stan in Prague, and when I was at Harvard, someone who'd been trained by Jung but was a professor at the Divinity School at Harvard, had spoken to me about this in such a way that gave me some reason to think there might be some value, that Jung had used it and so forth.
But the important thing, as you tell the story, is that as a young student at Harvard, even though you were very close with this man, and he was close with your girlfriend and so on.
Oh, he was the therapist for my girlfriend. Yeah. And then we were just meeting once. He was about probably 20 years older than me, and we would have conversations once or twice a month about this.
Which you found very stimulating as a student. And the key point is when he came in and asked you something about your birth chart, and then at a subsequent conversation mentioned something he'd derived from it, you very quickly steered the conversation away, because as a good Harvard student in those days, you found it really inferior to talk about astrology and a bit embarrassing. And so this is important, because most times when we'll find out in your book, when the modern mind encounters astrology, unfortunately, the only thing that most people know about it is this kind of flatlander attempt to be concretely predictive, as you say, which is very literalistic and is really not the essence of a true, deeper understanding of what wisdom we can gain from ancient astrology. So we want to say that right up front, that you came in as a skeptic and gradually opened your mind to these possibilities. And the same thing with Stan.
Yeah, both of us had that. And I mean, we were both, explorers of the new paradigm, as it's now called. But I think astrology, we would both agree even to this day, that astrology seemed like the last possible perspective that one would take seriously, that was beyond the acceptable paradigm borderline. So we'd had these initial experiences that gave us some pause about it, but still neither of us were, pursuing it in any way. And then when we were at Esalen and working together, and we were basically dealing with a kind of mystery of why people had such, he had 20 years of these of records of people doing their psychoanalytic process using LSD as an adjunct, and people would have such radically different experiences with the exact same substance at different times. And none of the standard psychology tests that they tried in the research institutes that Stan had been part of in Prague and Maryland had had any success in predicting the response that these different individuals would have to the same substance used at different times. MMPI, the Rorschach test, the TAT, none of these were of any value. Well, someone came through Esalen one time named Arne Tretovic, and he was an astrologer. And I mean, many people took astrology seriously at Esalen in a way that I didn't when I got there. It was kind of almost part of the ambiance of Esalen, which is this very kind of counterculturally robust place where many different perspectives that were esoteric and, you know, mystical and tantric and so forth were being explored there, yoga and Taoism and so forth. So it was part of the almost enchanted spiritual, intellectual, psychological milieu of the place.
And we might pause just a second atmospherically for those that have not been there to say it's located about a 3.5 hour drive south of San Francisco in the gorgeous Big Sur mountain range, which comes right down to the sea. Cliffs plunge a couple hundred feet down into the sea. It's where Henry Miller lived when he wrote the book Oranges of Hieronymus Bosch, and he used to go down and bathe in the hot waters that are there right on the edge of the ocean that Native Americans had been using as sacred springs for many, many generations. So in a sense, this exquisite spot had a long history of healing and opening to the cosmos in many ways. And as you point out, the work in depth psychology coincided, in a sense, with a great deal in literature of the so-called erotic liberation, a liberating eros energy that came with D.H. Lawrence, with Henry Miller, and many other authors in the same time frame that Freud and Jung were opening up this perspective. And we might just add, with respect to LSD, for those that are not as acquainted with the reason why Stan Grof was using this is that in traditional Freudian talk analysis, the gift of the therapist was to listen acutely as the person free associated and identify when the person might be touching on an area that could point to a complex that could be illuminated. And what Stan found was that when people did these controlled LSD experiences, that the psyche itself on its own, with the ingestion of the substance, was able to kind of track like radar those hot spots in the psyche, which would then allow the analysis to proceed in an even faster and more efficient way. So it wasn't just a matter of taking a drug to get an altered state of consciousness, but Stan was using it very precisely to advance the profession, if you will, of psychiatry.
And many therapists in a variety of modes of psychotherapeutic practice, Gestalt, example, as well as Jungian and psychoanalytic and Reichian, were convinced that the use of different, the skillful use of different psychedelic substances represented the future for effective psychotherapy. And I think, you know, many who are in the know continue to believe that, but our government's policies have not been, let's say, coming from the wisest place in the in the culture.
And like all governments before and after, they found a way to ban these,
research.
The research and also the sacred substances. Like there were cultures that took peyote or ayahuasca or other forms, even in Europe, of plant substances that were the natural essences of what Albert Hofmann, in a sense, distilled into a chemical substance. And in every one of those societies throughout history, those who were rulers in the elite oftentimes began to ban the substance so that there would not be the opportunity for people to go direct. And in a way, that's what Luther was protesting in the Catholic Church, that he didn't want the mediation of what he saw as a corrupt priesthood and hierarchy to stand between man and his free, direct relationship to the divine. So that's another way of lensing it as well.
Yeah, I think in some ways you can look at the, you can see the Reformation as the kind of breaking through of the individual's direct relationship to the divine, and that the kind of psychedelic revolution of the later 50s and 60s and beyond was a further step in that development. Well, getting back to your original question, what occurred there at Esalen was, you know, people were coming and having, you know, very powerful transformative experiences just walking onto the grounds, you know, and doing their workshops. And people seemed to come there at times in their lives when they really wanted to go through significant transformations and were willing to do that. And I think there was almost something about the land and the sea and the air and the morphic field of the place that helped elicit these powerful kinds of experiences. So when we learned, this individual named Arne Tretovic came through and showed us how to calculate birth charts and transits, and we discovered that this was the one method that permitted us to get a grasp of an extraordinarily illuminating perspective on what the nature of the experience that a person would be likely to have during a particular time period, both the timing of it and also the archetypal character. Because it turns out, as Jung said many times, that astrology was using as its basic principles of understanding these archetypal forms, you know, whether we call them gods and goddesses, you know, Mars and Venus and Neptune and Mercury and so forth, or whether we think of them as Jungian archetypes, psychological principles. You know, James Hillman is very good, you know, as the founder of archetypal psychology, he's very good at, in a sense, calling these archetypal principles gods and goddesses as well, because mm-hmm. they are in
definitely.
Some sense their numinosity, their transcendence, their power is something that should not be simply categorically subsumed under a kind of
mental construct.
That's right.
Yeah, because then we might think it's a projection of the human, which falls
exactly.
into the human mind constraint, rather than acknowledging that there are powerful forces that have in ancient cultures been reified as gods and goddesses given personalities in recognition of their independent numinosity and power that one can dialogue with, rather than just project onto an inert universe a superstitious notion that, oh, well, there's a fire god, which is what the modern mind tends to do with the primal experience.
Well, what I mean, and Jung was very sensitive to that very fact, and he recognized that the astrological principles, deeply understood, were essentially equivalent to the archetypal principles that he was working with, that he empirically uncovered in his work with many patients over and himself over many years, and even Freud, in a sense, was getting a glimpse into the archetypal realm. As Hillman says, Eros and Thanatos and id and ego and superego, these are essentially archetypal mm-hmm. principles. Freud was really, as Wittgenstein said, describing a mythology. Psychoanalysis was a new mythology. Jung made that explicit, and he widened it, he deepened it, he went through the veil that that Freud had kind of pierced with his notion of libido. Jung walked through that veil and into the larger, you know, collective unconscious, and saw the full pantheon of the archetypes. And Stan Grof basically entered into it through these very powerful modes of, accessing non-ordinary states of consciousness.
And here we might add Joseph Campbell's great comment, who was your colleague for many years at Esalen.
Teacher and colleague, yes,
yeah.
And friend.
Whereas he said, Freud was fishing sitting on a whale.
That's right.
You know, that he opened up the veil to psychological mythology. He used references to Greek myth like Oedipus and so on, the Oedipus complex, the Electra complex. But actually, it was Jung that saw there was this vast oceanic consciousness underneath it all, well beyond personal biography, and accessed by individuals, as in the Tale of the Scarab, or where, you know, the client of Jung's had an image of an animal, in this case.
She had a dream of the golden scarab.
Of the golden scarab from Egypt, right?
That's right.
Yeah, which had nothing to do with her experience in her personal autobiography in Europe, but did in fact exist in, you know, another part of the world, and it was accessed in a dream.
That's right. Well, Stan Grof's work had entered into this world, into this, you know, realm through these non-ordinary states of consciousness, but it also, he had focused on birth, interestingly, because over and over again, his patients were showing that it was the encounter with, first of all, very early childhood experience, which is so psychologically potent, as Freud and psychoanalysis recognized, but that even beyond that, there was an even more powerful, more intense, and more determinative realm of the unconscious, which Stan named the perinatal unconscious, because people who entered into it experienced very intense encounters with their own birth, memories of their own birth tied to experiences of dying and death. And it was through that they entered into these larger transpersonal and archetypal realms. So as a result of that, we got an insight into one of the reasons why astrology has traditionally focused on the birth chart, the natal chart, for so long, is that birth itself seems to be a threshold of transformation, a kind of a place of maximum impact, as it were, from where our psychology, in a sense, is being shaped in very fundamental ways right into our body through this powerful psychosomatic experience of birth.
Like a very personal template.
That's right.
You know, for each individual, this is the template, in a sense, you know, the way the Vedic astrologers and the Hindu mystics talk about it is that the position of the stars in the sky when you're born is karmically representative of your soul's unfoldment, so that you're given certain kinds of energetic patterns in this template to work with in this lifetime. And whether it's, we'll find out later, you know, the sun square Saturn or whatever, there are kind of obstacles and opportunities here that your psyche has to go through in order to get the complete mandala of, we might say, liberation. So in a sense, it's a gift to every one of us to know about our natal chart, because it does illuminate what points of reference we can go through in our own life journey as a psyche and a soul unfolding.
Really what we, in some sense, the birth chart seems to represent a kind of it's a portrait of the heavens at the moment of birth, but in doing that, it's as if we seem to be born at that time when the planets are in a position that's most accurately symbolize the archetypal dynamics of our psyche as it unfolds through life and through our personal lives. But there does seem to be this way, as the esoteric masters and mystics suggest, that we're only born at that moment that will accurately reflect somehow our karmic legacy, that's not an accident that we're born with a certain chart and so forth. And to follow up the thought that you're pointing to there, this can be very liberating. Just the opposite of it being a prison of fatalistic determinism, it seems to give us an entirely new manner of being more conscious of the forces that within us that are unconscious otherwise, and that's the whole project of depth psychology, is to make the unconscious conscious, and
that is liberating. Yes,
which is extremely liberating, because then we're not puppets of the archetypes, and we can participate more intelligently in their expression. So, from that point of view, astrology well used is something that can actually be emancipatory rather than a constraint of determinism.
Well, this is a fabulous introduction to our second half hour, and I think just to wind up this half hour, this is a beautiful introduction to what we'll talk about in the next half hour, of how we can see in the collective unconscious certain patterns, say between the 1960s and the French Revolution and so on. But maybe we should wind up, since you've done all the personal study as well, just very briefly talking about Freud's birth chart and Jung's and Stan's and maybe your own, just to set the table. And if you want to be modest, we can just do Freud Freud and Jung and Stan, since we're on that topic, and show how each of them in their life work actually lived out brilliantly the potential, or one of the potentials of the archetypal template that was present at the time of their birth.
Well, even if we just focus on one of those.
Well, just let's take one as an example.
We'd be seeing.
Because we're coming down to the end of our half hour.
Exactly.
Let's just take one.
Let's take, Jung, for example. Jung, with his very powerful Sun Neptune aspect. Neptune was a major aspect to his Sun, a square. And people who have whatever your Sun is in major aspect to it, that archetype tends to be highly central to the personality, but also depending on the aspect, it has a specific relationship to the basic sense of selfhood. And in Jung's case, Neptune relates to the realm of myth and dreams and fantasy, and but also spirituality, mysticism, the whole transcendent, invisible dimension of being. Mm-hmm. And to have that in such tight aspect to his son indicated a person who, in a sense, he represents, not in his own life and for the culture, he kind of mediates access to that whole realm. And at the same time, he was having to engage it in a way that was very challenging because the square is not an easy aspect to deal with. And he, at times, for example, he was going through extremely powerful experiences when that aspect was being transited in the 1913 to 1917 period. He was going through extremely challenging experiences where he felt like his sanity in some sense was being tested, and he'd be sitting on his chair and reminding himself, okay, I'm Dr. Carl Gustav Jung. I live at this address. I see my patients the next morning. I will be seeing them. I have, I'm married and have five children and so forth. Well, what he's doing with that, he describes this in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. What he's doing there is he is establishing his identity, his solar selfhood, but he's having to do it in contradistinction to this kind of influx of the Neptunian realm of mythic complexes and powerful transpersonal experiences that were essentially mediating a kind of shamanic transformation for him. Mm-hmm. So this is one little thing that could be said about Jung's chart, but he has each chart really takes 2 hours to even begin to give the headlines for.
But this certainly gives us a very tantalizing introduction to what will be our second half hour here of how you have done this great masterwork, Cosmos and Psyche, and all the gifts that are given in it. And so for that, Rick, I just want to thank you for the perseverance and the great patience and open-heartedness and open-mindedness that you describe on your own journey. You had to develop from your initial education as an intellectual and one who was well-educated in the modern mind to open up to these insights. It's been a great journey. It's a great journey to take with you when we read this book, and it's a great pleasure to spend this time together and to have you as a personal friend.
Thank you so much, Duncan.
I'm your host, Duncan Campbell. I'm inviting you to stay with us as we continue with Rick Tarnas on Living Dialogues. And once you have entered your free subscription to the Living Dialogues podcast here on Personal Life Media, future Living Dialogues will automatically be downloaded to your computer on a weekly basis. If you'd like to obtain a full transcript of this dialogue or additional dialogues I've done with the many other transformational thinkers listed on my website, livingdialogues.com, that's livingdialogues.com. You can contact me at duncan@personallifemedia.com. Thanks again for your deep listening. All the very best. And stay tuned now after the music for some very interesting opportunities available to you as a listener to Living Dialogues.
Find more great shows like this on PersonalLifeMedia.com.